I'm Martin Reeves, chairman of the B.C. Henderson Institute. Welcome to our Thinkers and Ideas podcast, where we discuss important new books and ideas in business. Joining me today is Venki Ramakrishnan. Venki is a structural biologist leading a group at the MLC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge. His research was awarded a Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2009 for his work on the protein factories of cells, the ribosomes. From 2015 to 2020, he served as president of the Royal Society. That's the sort of UK's National Academy of Sciences, if you will. And he's just written a wonderful book about life extension. It's called Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality, which came out in March 2024. In it, Venki explores the science of why we age and die, looks at recent breakthroughs, and also discusses the broader social, economic, and ethical implications of all of this. And I'm really looking forward to discussing it with you, Venki. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So why did you decide to write a popular book on longevity? You're a Nobel Prize-winning scientist. I'm sure you're busy with your research. What was your motivation?
Well, several things. Firstly, my own area of research, which is how the body makes proteins and how it regulates their production and quality control, is a central process that's affected in aging. So the breakdown of that process is one of the major processes involved in aging. A second reason is that although we've known about aging and death for centuries, we haven't been able to do anything about it. But recently, in the last 50 years, we've developed a real understanding of the molecular biology underlying aging, and we might be in a position to actually intervene in some of these processes. Now, this has also led to an enormous growth and investment in the aging community, in research and in entrepreneurship. And not surprisingly, it's also led to a huge amount of hype. And so my goal was to look at the recent advances, but also try to cut through the hype and ask what's possible.
Very good. So before we jump into that and we decode the hype, let's define our terms. Now, it seems to me you make some important distinctions between maximum lifespan, life expectancy, and health span. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So life expectancy is how long can you be expected to live? And typically that's calculated at birth. So it's life expectancy at birth. And in most advanced countries, that's about in the 80s. Health span is how many healthy years can you be expected to live? So life expectancy keeps on going up, but health span only increases proportionately. So we are spending a larger fraction of the end of our lives in decline and decrepitude. Maximum lifespan is how long could you live as a human being if everything went right? You didn't get cancer, you didn't get this or that, you know, dementia, diabetes, etc. How long could you possibly live? What's the maximum life possible for you as part of this species? And for humans, that's about 120 years old. The record holder is 122, but no one else has surpassed 120 since the French woman Jean Calment died in 1997.
Okay, thank you. Now, before we talk about the current revolution in longevity, we could say that we've already experienced one revolution. I believe that we've something like doubled the lifespan of humans in the past 100 years. So if we look back, how was that first revolution achieved?
Right. So since we defined our terms, I think what has doubled is the life expectancy at birth. Because even in Victorian times, there were people who lived to a ripe old age, what we would consider a ripe old age. It's just that on average, people lived only to about 40. And the reason for that was mainly infant mortality. When children were born, they would get infectious diseases, they would die of accidents, all sorts of reasons why they would die. They would die of starvation. And the biggest advances were due to public health, especially clean water and proper sanitation, an improvement in the food supply. So food has become more abundant and cheap, so we're not starving as much. And things like vaccination, and then later on antibiotics to help us with infectious disease. That caused a dramatic increase and allowed people to get through childhood. But then at the other end, we also made advances. For example, we know how to treat diabetes, we know how to treat cancer better, heart disease, all of these things. Medical advances have made it possible to survive longer. And so most of the advances, infant mortality, and then some additional advance due to these chronic diseases of old age.
And do you think this particular well is dry, or will these advances in public health, nutrition, and so on continue without any special molecular engineering or whatever? Would the average life expectancy still increase?
Well, in the US, it's definitely plateaued off. And the reasons for that are not entirely clear, although they think obesity, for example, may have something to do with it. And I'm not talking of the sudden drop because of the COVID pandemic. That's a separate issue. But even before that, it was plateauing off. However, I think there are advances. If we can make progress against dementia and, you know, those diseases of the brain, we would gain something. Treatments for diabetes, heart disease, and cancer are always improving. And so if we can also solve the obesity crisis, that will help us. Beyond that, though, you'd have to tackle the underlying causes of aging, because the risk factor for most of these diseases, one of the biggest risk factors is age. So there's a view that if you can tackle the fundamental causes of aging, that you will help with all of these things, and that might get us more years.
Well, let's go there. Interestingly, you observe in your book that the lifespan of animals tend to increase with size. Are humans any exception, and why is that?
There are exceptions, but by and large, the larger the animal, the larger the species, the longer lived it is, on average. And this has to do with an evolutionary trade-off. It costs evolution energy and resources. It costs biology energy and resources to maintain and repair a body so that it can continue to live for a long time. That wouldn't be worth it if that animal was going to be eaten or starved to death long before aging set in. For example, a mouse only lives about 2 years, and even in the lab, if you try to keep it, you know, alive, might live for 3 or 4 years. But there are species like the Galapagos tortoise or the bowhead whale or the Greenland shark, which live several hundred years. And so this is because the equation, the evolutionary selection equation, provides a different answer for each species, and that balance is different for different species. There are exceptions. One interesting exception in mammals are bats. Well, bats can fly, so they can escape predators better. They can also have a larger range for foraging, so they won't starve as easily. And so there, it does pay to have bats live longer, because all evolution cares about is what is the likelihood that you'll pass on your genes, and that's what it tries to optimize.
So let's go into aging. You paint a picture that aging is not simply an issue of things breaking down. It's some sort of active process with specific mechanisms, and you detail some in your book, like telomere contraction, epigenetics, and so on. Take us through what we currently know about the mechanisms of aging.
Well, in a way, aging really is the accumulation of damage to our molecules and thereby our cells and tissues. So it really is accumulation of chemical damage until some critical system failure occurs. That is, critical cells, for example, our heart muscles or our brain stops working, and that results in our dying. Now, remember, when you die, most of your cells are still alive. In fact, your entire organs are alive and can be donated to organ recipients. So death is simply the loss of that coordination that allows you to function as an individual. And that is the result endpoint of aging. Aging is a sort of gradual process, and when it reaches some critical point, you get death. And that aging can happen for many reasons. One of them is DNA damage from the environment and so on. Another is the telomere clock that you mentioned. This has to do with each time a cell divides, the chromosomes shorten a little bit. And that means you get loss of the ends of DNA, which are called telomeres because they have a special structure. And when that reaches a critical point, the cell goes into senescence. Senescent cells can no longer divide. Sometimes they actually induce the cell to commit suicide. And that's also another point of aging. DNA methylation is one form of epigenetics. These are where chemical tags are added to DNA as we age. And they have the effect of shutting down genes. They're useful early on. Early on, they prevent cancer. But later on, as they accumulate, they prevent some of our normal function of our genes and cause aging. Apoptosis is the alternative to senescent cells, where cells are actually induced to die. And protein folding dysfunction is another cause. This is where the proteins that we make in our body don't fold into their natural and correct shapes and function as they should, but they're misfolded or sometimes they're made erroneously. And they tend to cause problems in the cell because they can aggregate and form large tangles. These tangles are often associated with diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or various forms of dementia. So there are a number of causes. Another important cause is that we have organelles in our cell, which are remnants of bacteria from 2 billion years ago. And they're called mitochondria. They're the energy powerhouses in our cell. And when those mitochondria age, they don't work well, and they affect the rest of the metabolism of the cell as well. And so that's another important cause of aging. So what I wanted to point out is that aging occurs at every level, from the molecular to the inside of a cell to cells themselves, and they're all interconnected in some ways.
So help me to understand, to reconcile that with the causes of death view of things. So another way of answering the question would be, you know, we die of this dementia, we die of diabetes. Are these underlying mechanisms the things which permit and facilitate disease, or are they more the sense that even if you didn't have a particular disease, these mechanisms would eventually kill you? How do I reconcile these two views of the world?
Aging makes these diseases more likely because aging prevents normal function. It's a slow deterioration of function. And so all of the normal processes, for example, which keep the system ticking away, for example, there's a process which removes dysfunctional molecules from the cell called autophagy. That breaks down with aging. So then you get a pileup of essentially garbage in the cell, you know, or atherosclerosis, another thing which, you know, early on in life, you clear all these things. Later in life, those mechanisms for repair and maintenance themselves break down. So I think aging is a common risk factor for many of these diseases of old age. Some people would like to say that aging is the cause of many of these other diseases, or a cause. Even cancer, our risk of cancer increases with age. It's not just, I mean, young people do get cancer, but that's less common than in older people.
So let's come on to specific life extension solutions, both established ones and ones in research and maybe even the speculative ones. You deal with a number of these in the book. Tell us, maybe starting with the ones that we already know a lot about and are well understood, what are some of these potential interventions which could extend life expectancy or even lifespan?
Sure. So one of the interesting findings was that caloric restriction in animals extends lifespan and health as well. And this is the idea that if you provide an animal just enough calories so it's not malnourished, it doesn't lose weight, it's not unhealthy, then that animal tends to remain healthy longer and lives longer. And the big advances in the last few decades has been understanding the link between caloric restriction and some of our metabolic pathways. Now, understanding those pathways means that you could try to intervene and mimic the effect of caloric restriction. And one very widely studied drug is called rapamycin, which inhibits a major pathway called the TOR pathway in our cells, which affects a lot of things, including our ability to make proteins, our ability to clear garbage, etc. So rapamycin is an example that's being studied. Of course, rapamycin is also an immunosuppressant. It gives, you know, it's given to transplant patients to prevent graft rejection. So the question is, can you get the benefits without the potential side effects of being more prone to infection or having other problems. Another interesting idea is that people found that if you transfuse young blood, if you get a transfusion of young blood into an older animal by connecting their circulatory systems, slightly bizarre experiment, but it's been done many times, and the old animal benefits from the young blood from the younger animal. And conversely, the young animal also deteriorates or suffers bad effects from older blood. And so this led to some weird companies that start selling blood plasma from young donors to rich people who wanted to stay young. But actually, behind all the hype, there is some science, which is people are trying to find out what the factors are in young blood that differ from old blood, and which of these have benefit and how do they act. And so as we understand more, we will come into that. A third thing is that I mentioned that cells go into senescence. Now, these senescent cells aren't just dormant. They secrete inflammatory compounds. And that had a purpose, which is to attract the immune system there to repair wounds or heal from an infection. But as we accumulate these senescent cells with age, we get a problem of general inflammation. It's generally bad for you. So targeting these senescent cells specifically has also, in mice, resulted in improved outlook in the mice. Certainly many of the symptoms of aging have improved in these mice. And then perhaps the most sort of exciting, but also the most difficult pathway is called cellular reprogramming, or, you know, regenerating stem cells, which are the cells that regenerate all our tissues. And that's a problem with age. We start depleting our stem cells and we start losing the ability to regenerate. And people have found that by clever addition of certain factors, you can ask a cell to go backwards in development. So you could persuade it to go back to being a stem cell from a fully developed cell. And that has worked in mice. I found the papers rather interesting to read. I would not have predicted that. But of course, stem cell therapy is also fraught with lots of risks. For example, if you wanted to rejuvenate, you do run the risk of cancer. And many of these factors are actually oncogenes themselves that cause cancer. So you would have to somehow figure out a way to make it safe and also make it effective. Not all our organs age at the same rate, and how would you target it and how do you get that to work optimally? So this is a field, very exciting, but I would say lots of promise, but in its infancy.
And there are some even more speculative therapies that you touch on in your book. I mean, there has been some interest in cryotherapy, cryogenics, let's say, and also at least in Hollywood, the idea of capturing our thought processes in immortal AI avatars. Any thoughts on these?
Well, I think those lie squarely in the realm of science fiction. I certainly wouldn't spend any of my money on any of those at the moment.
Right. So these therapies, assuming that some of them play out, would they change lifespan, this 120-year threshold, or would they primarily work on life expectancy, do you think?
I think the goal of many serious scientists working in this is to increase healthy lifespan, health span. That is, increase the fraction of our lives that we stay healthy. But of course, this begs the question that if you stay healthy, why would you rapidly decline? You know, so my guess is it's very difficult to extend health without also extending overall life expectancy. And then at the other end, you might still have this gradual breakdown, which is what people want to avoid, you know, this long period of decline. Reducing that period is called compression of morbidity. And it's not, to me, a solved problem. I don't see it as a solved problem. However, supercentenarians have been studied, for example, by Tom Perls in Boston. And what he has found is that people who live over 105 or 110 tend to live extraordinarily healthy lives for a very large fraction of their lives and then go into a rapid decline. So at least these people have managed to compress that period of morbidity at the end. And one question is, how do they do it? And is it replicable in other people? Because it may be some very complicated combination of genes and their, you know, some random things that happen to their lives and so on, or lifestyle. So I think it's a, Very interesting question, but not yet, I would say, solved. And as to the question of whether we can go beyond 120, I think there's no theoretical reason why we couldn't. For example, you know, we're all made of DNA and proteins and lipids and so on, but there are species that live several hundred years, including mammals. You know? So I would say it's theoretically possible, but it might be very, very difficult to actually figure out how to do that and remain healthy. And one big problem is dementia and the brain. You know, how do we avoid that? And that's not really clear.
So if I could invite you to speculate or put in context the degree of practicality or realism of these different therapies, are we just a few years away from major breakthroughs in this space, or you know, is it going to be decades? And which of the things that you mentioned are more progressed? Because it's a hard question to sort through from a sort of an amateur's perspective. I mean, we see money going into the research in these areas. We see sort of, at least in this part of the world, the West Coast where I live, we see longevity clinics that give rapamycin therapy and so on. So where are we in the spectrum of practicality?
I think a lot of these people are jumping the gun. You know, this reminds me of Roy Amara, the futurist, who said, people tend to overestimate the short term and underestimate the long term. And we've seen that over and over again with all sorts of things, gene therapy, AI, the internet. You know, we always tend to overestimate and hype initially. Then there's a long period of disillusionment. And then eventually something does materialize. And I think something like that may well happen with aging because there's a huge amount of money in it right now. I think a lot of these people are going to be disappointed, but eventually there will be breakthroughs. I think it's very hard to predict how long it'll take. It could be a decade or it could be many decades. The other thing I should say is it's not easy to actually establish safety, efficacy, etc., because aging is not classified as a disease either by the FDA or by the WHO. So what do you do with clinical trials? And so you would have to use some of the diseases of old age, like osteoarthritis or various chronic diseases that I mentioned. You would have to use them as a proxy and treat those, or you would have to agree on a set of markers of aging, for example, DNA methylation or various blood markers, and ask, does your treatment improve those markers? And are those markers, they have to agree that this set of markers really represents biological age. It's not just one thing or the other. It really represents, you know, what we would think of as physiological age. And so there is progress in those areas. And so I think being able to measure aging is the first step to being able to see how effective your treatment is. So I would say things are happening. There are lots, as I say, there are lots of money, 700 startup companies and many tens of billions of dollars, not to mention all the big government funding agencies in most countries, in developed countries, because it's a big social problem with an aging population. So with all that effort and some of the brightest scientists being attracted to it, I would say something will happen. But remember, cancer therapy, you know, or even something like a statin took 20 years to go from a well-established concept to something that people, you know, take as a pill every day. So I think people are underestimating how long it'll take to actually get the thing. But of course, in California, people often jump the gun and do things on their own and go off prescription and so on. But I wouldn't recommend that.
So if we zoom forward and we assume that on some timescale, let's say several decades, as you indicated, some of these therapies pay off and we actually do succeed in extending life expectancy, what are some of the broader implications and complexities that would result from that?
There's no law that it'll result in a population explosion because, for example, in the past, when life expectancies increased, it's also resulted in a sudden burst in the population. But you know, the example of Japan shows that Japanese gained life expectancy in the last few decades, and their populations actually stayed stable or even declined somewhat. But the alternative then is that you would have a very long generation times, and you would have a relatively slow turnover of generations. And so you would have, I think, a stagnant society because people don't like to admit it. You know, we admit that we can't run 100 meters as fast as we could when we're 20, but we like to think of ourselves cognitively and mentally as all there when we're older, but we're actually most creative when we're younger. If you look at Nobel Prizes or even writers writing their best works, it's often done when people are young. Social change is often driven by the young. Things like fairness and so on in society is often driven by the young. And I think having the same people in power for a very long time, people also, as they get older, consolidate both economic and political power. So that creates this large asymmetry. And that, too, is not, I think, ideal for society. So I think we need to think through, or at least discuss and anticipate, some of these problems.
If we go back 100 years and we saw this process of public health increasing life expectancy, we could have worried about a very similar set of things, right? We could have said it's going to result in a population explosion, it's going to result in a consolidation of power, a stagnant society. Are we basically in the same situation as 100 years ago, or is there something fundamentally different about the current potential revolution in life expectancy?
You raise a very valid point in that more and more people are living longer now already, and society has already had to make adjustments compared to, say, 100 years ago, when a trivial example is Social Security. When Social Security was instituted, half the people were not even expected to reach pensionable age. And so it was set at some midpoint of life expectancy, and so half the people wouldn't even reach it. They wouldn't even get Social Security. Now, everybody outlives Social Security. I mean, not everybody, but on average, we outlive it by a decade or two decades. So you can see how it's already resulting in all sorts of social changes. And I just think if we started living beyond 120, certainly if many of us started living up to 100 or beyond 100, that would already involve some significant changes. What would careers look like? What would opportunities for younger people be like? What would politics look like? So I think there are all sorts of implications.
So unfortunately, our time is limited, although clearly the subject merits a deeper and longer discussion. So let me end with a few personal questions, if I may. So I notice on your bookcase behind you, you seem to have something which is perhaps a model of a ribosome and a cycling helmet. And I wanted to ask you, do you personally have a life extension wish and routine that you follow?
I don't have a particular life extension wish. I should say my father is 98 and still does his own cooking and laundry and cleaning and so on. So if you look at Tom Prose's data, that's one factor in longevity, is if you have long-lived antecedents. But I don't have a particular agenda, but I have been a vegetarian all my life, and I try to eat moderately. I bicycle everywhere. I exercise regularly, and I try to get enough sleep. I think those are three ingredients that currently work better than any anti-aging remedy. But having said that, I should tell you, I am on anti-aging medication. I take medicines to reduce my blood pressure. I take medicines for my cholesterol. In fact, those could also have been reduced by exercise and diet. And I tried that, but there was a limit to what I could do. And so I think much of the aging community would say, well, you know, this is to get beyond what you can do naturally. But currently, that trio of exercise, diet, and sleep works better than any anti-aging medicine on the market.
One final question, if I may. You clearly are very good at communicating complex ideas and accessible in a vivid way. We can see that from your book and from this podcast. And I think that's a sort of a needed, valuable superpower in today's age, where we have very fast technical progress and deep specialization of experts. And do you have a philosophy or techniques or thoughts about how to cultivate the art of communicating complex ideas in an accessible manner?
I think you have to assume that your audience is intelligent, but not knowledgeable in your area. So just try to think outside your own box for a while. Imagine what it's like not to know all this science, but you're curious. And so I try to talk from sort of basic principles, try to give them ideas, and try to give them analogies so they can understand how to visualize these ideas. I think it's very important. Science is largely funded, at least basic science like mine, is largely funded by the taxpayer. And so it's our duty to explain, you know, to a truck driver or a farmer why some of their taxes are going to fund my research, right? So I think it's a very healthy thing to cultivate, And it also is very good for generating public support for science. And prosperity today depends on science and technology, and most economies are basically knowledge-based economies. And so it is the duty of scientists, if they can, to spend some time communicating with the general public.
Well, thanks so much. And thank you for sharing your ideas with us today, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I've been discussing Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality, a new book by Renki Ramakrishnan, which came out in March 2024 from William Morrow. A really interesting book, I think, and as a business strategist, I felt that it sort of balanced my perspective beyond AI, where a lot of attention is currently being given to an equally potentially impactful set of technologies. It's a very understandable book. I think it brought the science to me in an accessible way, and I think helped me to think about the second and third order implications of the aging revolution that we've had and the one that we might have. So I'd strongly recommend the book. If you like this conversation, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcasting platform. And as always, we welcome your feedback.